Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Sam Wong here, faculty associate in law and public affairs and professor of neuroscience and molecular biology.
Well, today we face a number of big challenges, Sam, on national security and in international relations with the new president in the White House, soon to finish his first 100 days. There are many threats that both have emerged and continue from the previous administration, from the ongoing civil war in Syria and the recent use of chemical weapons to ongoing provocations by the North Koreans with the launching of missiles to U.S. relations with Russia, and obviously the continued threat posed by ISIS. These are simply a few of the challenges that both President Trump, the Congress, and the U.S. faces. And there have also been signs of tension between the president and the intelligence community that have been front and center. Sam and I are really honored today to have on the podcast General David Petraeus, who's currently the chairman of the KKR Global Institute. Prior to that, he, of course, served for over 37 years in the U.S. military, including command of coalition forces in Iraq, command of U.S. Central Command, and command of coalition forces in Afghanistan. He also served as the director of the CIA. He graduated with distinction from the U.S. Military Academy, and he attended Princeton University, where he received an MPA and PhD. He's received numerous awards, and my undergraduates today were fortunate to have him hear him speak about the surge that took place in the final years of the Bush presidency under his command. So, General Petraeus, welcome to our show.
It's great to be with you and great to be back at Princeton. Thanks, Julian.
So maybe we can just open up the show by asking you what you think maybe one or two of the major challenges in national security, what they are facing the Trump administration and where you think the administration and Congress should head in dealing with them.
Well, first is not a national security problem the way we would normally define those, and I'll go quickly through those in a moment. It's really a problem of organization. He's got to complete the staffing of his administration, which is well known as lagged a good bit over other administrations in recent decades, and still sees many senior positions not filled, still waiting for a deputy secretary of state. An announcement, I think, is going to be forthcoming. I've seen the name, but then there will be the confirmation process. Then obviously you've got to get the undersecretaries of state, virtually all of whom are gone except for one who has stayed on. And then the number of the assistant secretary of state positions. I think there are only three of those that actually are still filled because they were held by diplomatic professionals who have been asked to stay on. So a lot of effort that has to continue in that vein, and then also continuing to develop the policymaking process. Now in the very capable hands of Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, someone I know very, very well, who did essentially that, civil military strategic reviews for me when I was privileged to command the surge, then in Central Command, and was a one-star general under me in Afghanistan, where he established the task force to counter corruption in Afghanistan, a hugely significant problem. So you have the organizational challenges and the staffing issues, but then you have, I think, very quickly, six categories of threats that are out there. The most pressing of which I think we'll keep coming back to is North Korea and its nuclear program, because that can confront the president with a reality that's different from any of his predecessors, that a rogue state, a very impulsive, perhaps irrational figure, Kim Jong-un, could have control of a nuclear device that could actually hit a U.S. city in the continental United States. But so the categories of these would be the revisionist powers. These are the ones that are not satisfied with the status quo. It would be certainly Russia, Iran, North Korea, and China to a considerable degree. China being our number one trading partner now, but also, frankly, our biggest strategic competitor when it comes to the really important relationship, the most important in the world, which is that between the existing superpower and the rapidly rising superpower of the future, China. You have obviously Islamic extremists, the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, and their affiliates in a variety of places, although they're gaining a bit of momentum against them in a heartening way in Iraq, even in Syria, and some of the other places around the world, but a struggle that's going to be with us probably for a generation. And therefore, we have to have sustainable strategies in terms of blood and treasure. And we have generally achieved that in Iraq, and I think are in the process of achieving that in Syria. Cyber threats are increasingly important. And you not only have the nation state threats that are in some ways similar to the nuclear age, except that many more countries have them, and there are attacks every day. In the nuclear era, still continues to be sure, but deterrence had to deter every use. In this case, you have to deter certain types of use, something that would shut down our electrical grid or completely demolish the financial systems or something along those lines. And these are deployed not just by nation states and criminals, but worryingly by extremists, again, some of whom are willing to blow themselves up on a battlefield to take us with them, and therefore probably would not be deterred from hitting the send key if they had the cyber equivalent of a weapon of mass destruction. Beyond that, you have domestic populism, which has posed huge challenges to our NATO allies in many cases because of the tsunami of refugees out of Syria. We've seen Brexit. We saw the defeat of the Renzi reforms in Italy. The Netherlands held off a very hard right-wing xenophobic nationalist Geert Wilders, and the prime minister did prevail, so that could be the firebreak, but we'll have to see what happens with the French election for president that's upcoming, and then ultimately with the German election and at some point an Italian election as well. Frankly, we've seen domestic populism at play in our own country. I mean, certainly that was part of what took place in the past presidential election. There's more stress and strain on the international system as well. That's yet another challenge that is out there. Uniquely, I think, since the end of the Cold War era, there are more forces that are pulling and tugging on this rules-based international system that we and our allies built in the wake of the ruinous World War II following World War I and the greatest depression in history, and have generally served the world pretty well in the intervening decades. But now the greatest amount of stress on that, as I said, since the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War. And then finally, I think you have to actually include in the category of national security threats, slightly tongue-in-cheek, Washington, D.C. The dysfunction that has characterized Washington, that has, you know, we're midway through a fiscal year and most of the departments are still operating on continuing resolutions. For all of the emphasis on taking care of our men and women in uniform, we don't have a defense budget, much less one that should add the kinds of amounts that many of us think are warranted. And moreover, this is preventing us from resolving what you might term policy and legislative headwinds that are preventing us from capitalizing on the extraordinary opportunities we actually have, leading the world in the IT revolution, the energy revolution, the manufacturing revolution, and the life sciences revolution, something I've taught about over the past 4 years at the Honors College of the City University of New York up until the end of this past December.
One of the things I've always appreciated about you is you're a very clear thinker. And the more I studied about what was called the surge, there was a very understandable logic in the reorientation of policy that you undertook. With Syria, when you have kind of many bad choices facing the country between Assad and ISIS and the uncertainty of who rebels are, is there a way to think about that country and that problem in a way that might lead both the U.S. but obviously the region toward a different path?
I think there is. And as usual, you have to get the big ideas right up front. They become the intellectual foundation on which you then build your policy. And as I mentioned in your class earlier today, the surge that mattered most in Iraq was not the additional forces, the surge of forces. It was a surge of ideas. It was a complete change of strategy, literally 180 degrees in virtually every meaningful area of our strategy and the operations that we were carrying out. In the case of Syria, the big idea does have to change, I think, beyond defeating the Islamic State and the Al-Qaeda affiliate, which clearly has to remain mission number one and has been highlighted as such by the President and the Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense in recent days. But beyond that, instead of trying for the unachievable, which is a diplomatic resolution that results in a pluralist, multi-ethnic, multi-sectarian democracy in Damascus, I think the focus should be on stop the bloodshed. That becomes the second big idea, the second big objective. And if that is your objective, I think you actually start to take some different actions. You focus on what could indeed stop the bloodshed. How could we basically freeze the fighting? How can we get a ceasefire? And it will be perhaps in area by area. And we will have to show Bashar al-Assad that if he continues to take certain actions on the ground against forces that we've been supporting, that he will pay a price for that, just as he has paid a price for the horrific use of chemical weapons yet again against his own people. And by the way, I think there's absolutely no doubt whatsoever, having seen what the White House put out and having heard Secretary of Defense Mattis yesterday in a press conference establish the evidence, basically. This is not just intelligence. This is very concrete evidence of who did that attack, and it very clearly was an element of Bashar al-Assad's Air Force. But again, the big ideas have to change, and that second big objective of stopping the bloodshed has to be what you're pursuing. This may be an interim solution. You would have to announce it as such. No one can tell if you can truly put Syria back together again at this point in time, depending on a change in the leadership in Damascus. And I do believe that Bashar al-Assad can't be part of the long-term solution in the country. But I also believe, frankly, that we should be very careful not to push him out before we know what will replace him. Because we have seen what happens when autocrats are toppled and there is not an adequate plan for what will indeed provide the leadership of a country or an area in the wake of such an action.
I wanted to drill in just a little bit more, not so much what may happen in Syria and with the leadership there, but from the American end, the decision process. You said that you were being somewhat jocular about some of the things happening in Washington, D.C., but I wanted to get into that a little bit because it's a pretty unusual time for American leadership. If we think of the whole of U.S. history and this current administration as a stress test, there's on the one hand a community of professionals that you've given much of your career to, of intelligence and military officials, this interlocking network of people who work together, who have professional standards, who communicate with one another. And I guess that's sometimes been referred to as the deep state. And that's on the one hand a set of lifelong professionals with well-thought-out views, long-term plans, contingencies for everything. And now that collides with an administration that's understaffed, that's led by a man who, Donald Trump, who seems to have a pretty casual relationship with the detailed kinds of briefings that people give their lives over to. And it strikes me that there's this weird collision between well-thought-out plans and a guy who wakes up in the morning, you know, remembering he had cake with the premier of China, but not remembering what country he was aiming those missiles at. So what happens when this decision framework collides with somebody who might be a bit mercurial, who doesn't have a lifetime of thinking about foreign policy? How do his reactions get translated through McMaster, through Mattis, into something approximating a coherent response?
Well, first of all, you have to get a policy process, and that is being established. And really, I can't think of a better person to do that than Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster. As I mentioned, I've personally overseen him as he's done similar tasks with multiple ambassadors as his diplomatic wingmen, if you will.
And he's in control.
And he does control the policy process, albeit with the direction of the president and a lot of back and forth to determine the priorities, because you can only work on one issue at a time. There's only one set of principals, as they say, one set of deputies, although some of those are acting deputies, one set of those below for each of these different problems. But he is driving that process and beginning to build real institutional procedures and so forth quite rapidly. Again, a number of the individuals on the NSC staff are individuals I was privileged to serve with in the military or in the intelligence community, and they're all reporting that this is really coming together at this point in time, and actually that it really worked for the development of the options and ultimately the recommendation that the president approved for the action against Syria in the wake of Bashar al-Assad's regime forces using chemical weapons. Beyond that, I do think that over time, every president comes to appreciate the professionals, that they come to appreciate the selfless men and women in uniform, those in the intelligence community, those also in the Foreign Service, in AID, the development world, in the civil service more broadly. These are individuals who have, in many cases, or are in the process of giving their lives, their professional lives, to government service, generally doing it without a great deal of fanfare and so forth. And I think as he goes through these crises, he will remember who it is that actually came in with the coherent, well-staffed, well-developed, articulate options and recommendations, and will come increasingly to depend on them. And I think you're seeing this already because you see also General McMaster, in a sense, getting his way now in personnel issues on the National Security Council staff, and also bringing together the principles in, I think, quite an artful fashion, which is something for which he is known. He can both drive and build teams and organize, manage, and lead. So I think the president's very fortunate in his selection in that regard. And I think, again, that, yes, there are times when these communities will come up with something that makes a president uncomfortable. You know, he won't like the intelligence analysis that is produced. We've seen this with multiple administrations. I mean, it's well known that the community was under enormous pressure during the quest to find WMD in Iraq before the invasion of Iraq, to, in a sense, to justify something for which there seemed to be a desire to do on the part of some of the senior members of the administration. That's, again, not atypical of relationships between the chief executive and members of these professional groupings. And what they have to do is to remember that their job is to provide their best professional military, intelligence, foreign service, development, whatever it is, advice to someone who has won the election. And never forget who got the electoral votes, which is something that's occasionally good to remind yourself of if you're in one of these positions. But inevitably, who come to appreciate the extraordinary work that these individuals do for our government.
Applying the principle of civilian control over the military and over all these resources, the president is reputed to not be very interested in long memos. He likes to have things with graphics, not too many words. Should we be concerned or relieved that there are so many military and ex-military serving at high levels in the administration? That strikes me as something that's pretty unusual by modern standards. And
it is, but you know, we've had generals as national security advisors before. We've had generals as secretaries of state before. We had one who was both of those. We had one general who was the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of State, General Marshall. So really, I think it's more who is the person. Is the person the right person for it? Does the person appreciate that, again, it's the chief executive who got the electoral votes, and you might drive the process, but he determines the policy, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not that concerned about this. And I think that so far the results have shown that Secretary Mattis and National Security Advisor McMaster, General McMaster, are discharging their duties in a very dispassionate way. Clearly, we need to see the State Department get fully staffed up. We always want to avoid a situation which basically you have everybody trying to look at a problem with just a hammer in mind, because then every problem becomes a nail. So you've got to have the comprehensive approach. But H.R. McMaster, again, is a guy who understands the need for a comprehensive civil military approach in whatever it is we do, because he went through this during the surge in Iraq when that was the absolute policy approach. And that partnership that I enjoyed with Ambassador Crocker was so important to our effort.
The other big story, obviously, is the ongoing congressional investigation into the relationship between the Trump campaign and Russia. I'm curious, how do you think that is influencing right now, not just what the way the administration's perceived, but the way that it can handle some of these questions that emerge? It came up with Syria instantly.
Credibility.
Is this a distraction? And it is a question that comes up often in terms of what are the real intentions of statements about Russia. How does this kind of an investigation of such a serious matter impact the day-to-day decision-making process and what we can do right now with a very serious issue, one of the ones you discussed at the beginning?
Well, again, there's no question that a key actor on the international stage, very clearly took actions to interfere with our election process. You can question why that was. Did it actively seek to get one person an advantage over the other, or just to undermine the faith of the American public in our democratic system and the faith of others around the world in democracy as well? But at the end of the day, General McMaster is not involved in it. General Mattis is not involved in it. General Kelly at DHS is not involved in it. Tillerson's not involved in it. So there will be some, certainly there are people in the administration in very high positions who are very affected by this, just in terms of having to go do hearings and to do interviews and all the rest. By the way, keep in mind that although all the attention is on these fractious situations on Capitol Hill and the withdrawal of Chairman Nunes from the House Intelligence Committee oversight of this particular issue, and the Senate committee also preparing to look at it and already embarking on that, the investigation that matters most is the FBI investigation. That's the one that will be done quietly, professionally, and at the end of the day, the results provided to the Department of Justice with their sense of whether there is something there that should be pursued by a prosecutor. And that's the one to keep the eye on, but noting that it is one that is going to be very closely held based on what we've heard from the director of the FBI, who's given some information with approval of the Attorney General and Department of Justice, but is clearly trying to keep this as close hold as is absolutely possible. So again, I don't know that this is an enormous distraction for the policymaking process, and I don't know that it actually influences the policy all that much either. I mean, we've already seen the president and the Secretary of State and Defense take a very hard line on Russia, calling into question either Russia was lying or they're incompetent. Either of those is obviously not good. And Rex Tillerson in Russia right now, seeking to work with his counterpart and perhaps be granted an audience with President Putin, in which they can discuss why Russia is supporting an individual like Bashar al-Assad, who's carried out such barbaric activities against his own people, and by the UN count, and I think they've literally said they're stopped counting, has killed, responsible for the deaths of some 500,000 Syrian citizens.
You think, and you've studied a lot of history, the kind of intervention that we do know took place, is this on a scale and scope in terms of what's possible now and what we're seeing that's different than in the past? Or, as some say, is this a variation of the kind of interventions we've seen governments try to make in elections? Should we be worried? Are we seeing a new stage of interference in elections that can happen?
Well, it's a different type of interference at the very least. There certainly has been interference in the past. It's well known that the U.S. has used various of its organizations to interfere in elections, precipitated, quote, banana republic coups at various points in the previous century, the first half of the previous century, and even perhaps a bit beyond. Certainly other countries have been engaged. They support different political groupings covertly and overtly, and so on. So it's more that this is quite different in the sense that it exploited, obviously, what's going on in cyberspace. It took advantage of the internet and of email exchanges and data stored in servers and hard drives and cracked into those, and then selectively released what it was that they thought would create the most damage to whatever it was that they were seeking to damage or undermine. And so in that sense, I think it's quite dramatic. And I guess perhaps it's that, you know, we sort of thought the era of great powers trying to intervene in very nefarious ways was over, and clearly it is not. And we see, in, you know, it's not just in the United States. Several European leaders have said that they know that Russia and Russian organizations have been trying to intervene in their elections in various ways.
And I assume at some point non-great powers could potentially do this as well, meaning terrorist networks.
Right, this can be asymmetric because it just takes intellectual ability.
That's right. This is the fear. And as I mentioned earlier when I talked about non-state actors, extremist groups, having the cyber equivalent of a WMD is particularly worrisome. This would be not perhaps as bad as that, but could have very, very damaging effects, again, on at the end of the day, the very bedrock of our democracy, which is the faith of the people in our elected government.
And in this analogy, in this comparison, we're the Banana Republic and Vladimir Putin is the head of the United Fruit Company. Is this where we're heading here?
I'm not so sure about that. Well, that's a little bit more sophisticated.
You brought up Banana Republic.
Yes.
So what happens to FBI recommendations with an understaffed Department of Justice? It seems to me that there are some mechanisms, getting back to the stress test idea, there's some mechanisms that aren't necessarily guaranteed to work the way they usually do.
Well, always in government, if there is someone lacking in a certain position, someone below that person steps up and fills that position. So the fact that many prosecutors were thanked for their service to our country and allowed to move back to civilian life or private life doesn't mean that there is not someone acting as a prosecutor. I think the question is whether the wheels of justice can continue to grind on at the pace that they have traditionally moved, which is not always the most expeditious in the world to begin with, just in part because some of these take an awful lot of effort. And can the system handle this particular additional effort, which will be so, really, in some ways, so emotional and in such a glare of a spotlight once details are, as they will be, inevitably released, or as there are leaks, as we saw, I think, today, for example, that in a FISA warrant, this court that actually allows that to which you have to go to get a warrant to allow tapping or intrusion on a U.S. citizen actually did do that, apparently, for some individual who was advising the Trump campaign in some capacity.
Do you think we're missing? I mean, we're talking about all the issues that are at the forefront. That's what we've discussed. But what I've often learned, at least in the history, is there's always that threat we're missing. There's always the issue which later becomes apparent that we should have been focused on. So that was after 9/11, and the 9/11 Commission revealed, my God, we missed a lot on Al-Qaeda forming, or there's studies of the Iran hostage crisis. There's a book about this that says we were so focused on the Cold War, we missed what was going on with fundamentalism. Do you, and obviously I'm asking what we're missing, but do you see anything like that?
Julian, are those examples where we know what we were missing?
Well, those are examples where we later knew what we were missing.
So now we know?
Now we know.
Okay.
Is there anything like that that you see that we're not paying enough attention to? Not doing it the wrong way, but we're actually even not looking at it.
I do think that cybersecurity writ large, whether it's cybersecurity of big governmental data, big governmental programs, military networks, or perhaps most important of all, industrial control systems that operate our electrical grid and water systems, which in many respects are fairly old technology. Unfortunately, they're not completely analog, so they are vulnerable to digital challenges. But again, are a bit of yesterday's technology, albeit gradually being upgraded by some of the firms out there. That vulnerability is something that could be exploited, particularly, again, by a non-state actor. I think state actors will be deterred to a considerable degree by the prospect that we would figure out their return address and would take action against them. And they have to think that anything that they could do, we could do, perhaps do even better. So that is, I think, a very, very big concern. And also criminals in cyberspace are getting ever more creative, diabolically so. And for example, just locking down the data of a hospital system or a university or a financial firm and saying to their system administrator, send us 2 million in Bitcoin and we'll give you your data back. These are much more prevalent than people realize because you normally don't confess that if you don't have to, and because it can cause an effect of, you know, whatever it is, your stock price, your reputation, your what have you, or lead others to think that maybe they ought to try it as well. So these vulnerabilities, I think, are very significant, and I'm quite worried about those.
So this seems like it's part of a larger story. I mean, just to bring in a totally different topic, workers in the middle part of America, in the industrial heartland, who were trained for a past economy, and now their jobs have gone away, and then the new economy involves knowledge industries. Now we're talking about the security of infrastructure because of hackers, because of people who may wish to hack and invade these things. Which American institutions, I mean, I'm thinking about democratic institutions, which institutions are responding well to this and which need to respond better? And I'm thinking both about agencies, private sector, and even elected government, because it strikes me that there's a need in all those sectors to respond to the thing you're describing.
There is. And by the way, you touched on something that we should talk about right after this, which is the issue of technological displacement, which I think arguably could be yet another. It's certainly a threat to our economy of the future.
I mean, it feels related to the thing that you're talking about.
It is, I guess, just in the fact that we don't have enough of the high-grade cybersecurity talent that we need. This is the whole reason why the H-1B visa, the smart person visa, needs to be raised, not lowered, so that the tech firms can get all the people that they need, and so that we're not in this curious circumstance of helping someone come to college in the United States and then be deported because the person doesn't win the H-1B visa lottery that particular year. But the issue here is about, are there certain institutions that seem to be doing well? I'd say that military organizations generally have a great deal of focus on this, because if they are hacked, the result can be that the weapon doesn't work, or you can't communicate, or you lose your GPS coverage, or, you know, and. And I would have generally said that NSA has led the way in very impressive cybersecurity, or perhaps the CIA, except for the fact that there was a Snowden, and except for the fact of these latest damaging leaks, perhaps from contractors. It's hard to tell, because there are a lot of working papers. They're not the finished products,
there
but of hacking tools.
The reports about how serious that is have varied a bit.
Yes, indeed. And again, I think as we've come to look at it, they're ratcheting back how very important this is, except that it is just a reminder to extremists, to terrorists, to criminals, and to others that there are very impressive capabilities out there. And as with the aftermath of the Snowden revelations, terrorists really changed how they communicated, how they conducted command and control, how they proselytized in cyberspace. They got much smarter on all of this stuff. So there are ramifications. But really, I guess that the national government is putting reasonable resources into this, although the Department of Homeland Security, which is now the quarterback, is their term, for response to major cyber events, cyber offensives against United States firms, the United States government, clearly has to continue to build its workforce, its capabilities, its infrastructure, and so on. And Congress has been reluctant to provide them all that they have needed. And that's important because, again, another fallout of the Snowden revelations was that NSA couldn't do as much as a number of us hoped they would be able to do in the realm of cybersecurity in the homeland. And so that clearly became a radioactive issue, and DHS has had to take that on. That's a logical follow-on from that, but DHS is good an organization as it is, does not have the same kind of drawing power that the CIA and NSA do. There were literally people when I was director of the CIA who had run several startups in their life. They were set financially for the next several generations of their family, but they just always wanted to work for the CIA. And they came, and we got incredible talent as a result of this to help us work through issues of tradecraft in the cyber era when everyone leaves internet footprints and digital dust is left behind, that kind of thing. DHS doesn't yet have that same. There's not yet this cachet about being a techie at DHS yet. I hope it's coming, and I hope it develops, and I hope people realize that they can do their stuff that would get them thrown in jail if they did it in civilian life, because that's what attracted a lot of people to NSA and CIA. But so we'll see how that comes along. But the issue of technological displacement is an enormous one. It ties back into, by the way, the issue of bringing manufacturing back to the United States. The fact is, manufacturing is back in the United States. Our manufacturing output is at an all-time high. And I'm describing with my hands for the listeners a slope that's pretty steep up to the point we are now, which we've never been at in the past. Meanwhile, a flat line with my hand, employment in manufacturing has been slightly down and then slightly up in recent years. So I think we have to be measured in how much we think we can bring back jobs in manufacturing, even if we bring manufacturing back from overseas, which is something that is actually ongoing. And it's because the price of labor in the United States now, when you factor in productivity, is about the same as that of labor in places like China or even some of the very low-cost countries like Vietnam, because our workers are augmented by enormous amounts of automation and robotics and advances in three-dimensional printing and a variety of other technological leaps forward. Now, the implications of this are pretty stark for our country and indeed for every country around the world, and that is that the repetitive tasks are going to increasingly be performed by machines, whether it's computers with artificial intelligence and machine learning replacing humans in a variety of tasks, whether it's robots replacing laborers, whether it's, again, great automation replacing assembly line workers. This is going to sweep throughout industries, and the displacement effects are very considerable, potentially. We really don't know yet whether the so-called fourth technological revolution, which is what's ongoing now, will be different from the others before it when, for example, people were displaced from, say, the fields by greater automation to the factories or on as it has continued. And we will only tell over time. There's just not enough empirical data yet, although an awful lot of people have started to conclude, as the author of The Rise of the Robots, a particularly scary book on this topic, has, that many people will not be displaced from their current jobs to some other job. They will be displaced, period. So first, it has huge ramifications for your field, education, and actually mine too, as a professor at USC and a fellow at Harvard and so forth. So we've got to transform this, and we've got to prepare the workforce of the future better for what it is that will be needed. But we also need to be prepared for the reality that there may be some people who truly are displaced entirely and come to some grips on what are the options for dealing with that situation as well.
What about a national minimum national income?
Well, that could be. This is one of the ideas put forward in Rise of the Robots and in a number of other books on this topic. It is certainly something that I think has to be considered as an option, although I'd rather not see that just yet. But again,
sure, it goes against ideas about capitalism
and
society that currently exists.
Exactly right. You'd have to work your way through that intellectually and so on. And again, we just still don't truly know. I mean, we're thinking that what happens when all of these hundreds of thousands of taxi cab drivers are displaced in New York, the long haul truckers, the people in call centers, you name it. What happens? Where do they go? Are there good, decent-paying jobs out there for them? And only time is going to tell. But we can improve the odds of them being ready for the workforce needs of the future if we can overhaul our technical training, community college preparation, and indeed college educations as well.
So we have – so the other – one of the challenges you mentioned early on was Washington. And so now you've outlined many problems that we face, from displacement to cybersecurity to more. You've mentioned many people in the administration who you believe are offering sound advice and thinking about problems in the right way, McMaster, Mattis, and Kelly. But yet
– And Tillerson.
But yet we
and
have –
And by the way, also, I think deserves very special mention, Ambassador Nikki Haley.
And Nikki Haley.
Who is someone I think has been the really extraordinary, in a sense, surprise, really. I mean, who would have predicted that a governor of South Carolina would establish herself as quickly as she has as a hugely forceful personality at the United Nations, an organization that many in this administration thought little of, frankly, but she has shown can be a very important platform indeed if someone is willing to be very forthright, direct, and skillful in how she goes about advancing various ideas.
To what extent is she freelancing?
I think she's pushing the envelope, probably. And, you know, there is a bit of – we used to call it policymaking by speechwriting when I was a speechwriter, that if you can slip something into your boss's speech and get him to say it, that perhaps it can advance a cause. But she, you know, she's got to be very judicious with that. I think she probably knows where the – in a sense, the red lines in that particular activity are. But I have no doubt that she is a forceful advocate in the policymaking process. And she has been elevated, as many previous U.S. ambassadors to the United Nations have been over the years, in recent years in particular, to cabinet-level status. So she's at the table when they have principals committee meetings chaired by the national security advisors with the cabinet heads, and then National Security Council meetings when the president is at the head of the table with the same group.
But yet we have – so back in Washington, though, we have in Congress a pretty severe problem of partisan polarization and gridlock, and including within the Republican Party, a Freedom Caucus that has been unwilling to negotiate even with members of their own party. That's influenced budget policy, including for national security items, which I imagine has a really big effect if you can't plan what kind of money you're going to have or what's coming down the road. And two elements of President Trump's style that many people have noted are not usual, tweeting out kind of random thoughts on what leaders of state have said or done, and an atmosphere of uncertainty that many members of the Oval Office face in terms of what's going to come next. How does that Washington that everyone's watching, that everyone's reading about, affect the ability of the other people in the room to really deal with the issues you've laid out?
Makes it very, very difficult. We saw with the budget, with the effort on health care, that first of all, arguably pretty bad process if you try to jam something through as rapidly as that and don't have the Congressional Budget Office score it first. And then when you find out it's scored and it violates what the president has committed to the American people, that their health insurance would not be taken away from them, and it shows that 20 to 24 million would probably lose their health insurance as a result of the way this new program would operate, still pressed on. And then, of course, lost the Tea Party wing of the party. I actually think what it tells you is not only that this is very difficult, but that perhaps you ought to try to, instead of just doing everything in a partisan way, perhaps try rebuilding the center. Now, the center obviously has eroded because of gerrymandering of House seats in particular. The moderates, if you will, the centrists, the Red Dog Democrats, and the Northeastern Republicans are much fewer in number than they were in the past. And I encountered this when I was on Capitol Hill for the better part of, you know, a decade as a four-star general and three four-star commands in combat, and then as the director of the CIA. So you're not oblivious to this. This is part of the context in which you are operating. And at the end of the day, it may be one of those where if all else fails, maybe we should try compromise. You know, maybe we should actually try being bipartisan. Maybe you should try to rebuild the center on some issues that can do that. And I think the one, by the way, on which you can do that is not necessarily tax reform, not yet. I mean, if you thought health reform was tough, try tax reform. Rather, it is infrastructure investment. And so now's the time. And, of course, the wife of the Senate Majority Leader is the head of the department, which is preparing this big infrastructure investment plan.
Right. Lei Chow, Secretary of Transportation.
Yes. She is working very closely with the White House on this. Jared Kushner is engaged in this. I know. And, in fact, you could actually fund this if you're willing to take a piece out of tax reform, which the tax reform folks will be reluctant to do because it would fund some of the tax cuts that they would like to implement. But you take out of this, out of that, you take the repatriation of profits that are offshore. There's about $3 trillion of that out there, $2 trillion of which are liquid enough that they could be brought home if the tax break is sufficient. I think you could go as high as 15%, at least 12.5%. Definitely you'd get back, again, perhaps as much as $2 trillion of that. You're talking then about, you know, $200 to $300 billion of money for infrastructure investment. And then you create tax incentives, tax breaks, and so forth to encourage the spending of other elements of that money that's brought back for research and development, for other infrastructure, for anything, frankly, that will improve productivity of American workers. So not just buying back stock, which was the predominant use of the last tax break back in the Bush administration, much smaller amount was brought back and didn't have a huge effect on the economy. This, when you get done adding all this up and then throw in the normal amount that's in highway bills or whatever, could actually approach perhaps this $1 trillion figure that's been thrown around. And that would be very significant. Because if you come back to the issue we were talking about before, the technologies of the future, technological displacement as a huge hurdle that we're going to have to get over, what we need to do is focus on initiatives that will improve productivity of American workers. And that's not just the education piece and the training piece and the others that we were talking about earlier. It is the infrastructure that will enable them also to be much more productive as a result.
Your starting point in talking about infrastructure was talking about the need for getting away from partisanship and polarization. And you mentioned gerrymandering, which is actually a favorite topic of mine. Doesn't this require something to happen, either standards to make districts more competitive, so for instance, judicial action to reduce gerrymandering, or something to shake up political parties to make races more competitive? And at some level, there may be some of that happening this year. It feels like breaking the logjam requires breaking something there that's been, unbreaking something that's been there with some kind of shock to that system, whether it be, as I said, judicial or political.
Well, first of all, to come back to infrastructure just quickly, the reason I think that's an area around which you can build bipartisan support is because everybody wants something built in his or her district.
Of course.
Whether a member of the House or the Senate. So in that sense, this is a pretty popular action. I think you can get people to come to the table on this because they're all going to want their share of it. Beyond that, I very strongly feel that we should undo gerrymandering, that there should be actions taken as, for example, California has.
With the commission.
Yes, with where you have, and it's a bipartisan commission, as you know, where districts are drawn in ways that as closely as you can actually aggregate, say, counties or whatever sub-state organizations that you have, in a sense, on the ground, rather than these very contrived, incredibly elongated sometimes districts that sort of are drawn just to encapsulate all of the either Democrats or Republicans to ensure that it is a safe seat for one or the other. So a process which has taken sort of red seats and made them bright red and blue seats and made them bright blue and never the twain shall meet. So the number of competitive races, as you both know, has been dramatically reduced, except that the competition is in the primary rather than in the general election. So it's all about who can appeal most to the base of that particular party in that particular district.
Do you think so? We're almost out of time, but is there, from your perspective, can this president do any of this? Meaning, is there a will in President Trump, from you've met him and you know many of the players in the room, is there the will there to move the nation toward these kinds of solutions?
Or capability.
And capability and bipartisanship. Do you think that's something he would want to do or is capable of doing?
I think he actually is. Again, my impression from the conversations I had with him and so on are that he's very pragmatic and he wants to be a success in whatever it is that he does. And he will do what is necessary to be successful. So if the benchmark is the biggest infrastructure investment bill in history, he will go after that. That would be a definition of success. The question is, does he have people who can, in a sense, define that for him, who can then lay out pragmatic ways of achieving what the policy objectives that he has are? The truth is the health bill did not achieve what it was that he'd laid out for the American public when he said that you won't lose your health care, you won't lose your health care provider. So that was not the solution.
Well, wasn't staffed by people who would give him that.
Well, the CBO laid that out for him, however. But yeah, fair enough. And I mean, the problem was that it was such a compressed process. You know, people criticized the Obama administration on rushing it through. I think that was an 8 months rush through. This was 18 days from start to finish, obviously not to a successful finish. So again, I think as he can determine what is successful and what will the American people see as successful, I think he will have the determination to do that. And over time is going to gather around him the people who will enable that and get rid of the people who are going to disrupt efforts to do that. And we've seen that already. And you're seeing, I think, more quality people in a variety of key positions as this goes forward. The other piece is he is decisive. He took action in Syria when Bashar al-Assad's actions crossed lines for him. And that is very significant. We all know of the red line that turned out not to be a red line, and however good the outcome was, and we're now confirmed what a lot of us sense, that all the chemical weapons weren't removed from the country, and clearly that was the case. But regardless of how you look at that outcome, that undermined American credibility around the world. And anyone who disputes that hasn't talked to the people around the world that I've been privileged to talk to in the last 4.5 years, and indeed in just in the last several months in 16 different countries with leaders in many of those countries. So this will send quite a signal around the world. It does, I think, strengthen Rex Tillerson's hand in Moscow as he's negotiating with his Russian counterpart. And I think it indicates a willingness of someone, again, to make decisions. The key is, of course, to make sure he's got all the information to enable him to go through that, to lay it out for him, to make sure he really does internalize that before he makes that decision, and it doesn't result from a truncated decision-making process and a knee-jerk or perhaps even impulsive action.
Well, we are out of time, and that wraps up our episode. So thanks again to General Petraeus for joining us. It's an honor to have you in the studio.
The privilege is mine. Thanks.
And everyone, we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls. Take care.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series about the 2016 presidential election produced by WooCast. The content discussed in this podcast is intended to be informational only. It does not represent nor reflect the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.